Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation. And here's a question. Why does so much bad news keep coming out of Africa? It's not just about the politics. So much is going bad. AIDS, the spread of deserts, extinctions and starvation. The crops are failing. That's if they grow at all. Robert Pahlberg has one answer. He says Africa is starved of science. Indeed, that's the title of his book, boasting as it does a foreword from two Nobel Prize winners. But then there's the subtitle of his book, How Biotechnology is Being Kept Out of Africa. Kept? By who? Bob Pahlberg is a professor of political science at Wellesley College in Boston, Massachusetts, where incidentally Hillary Clinton studied, and he's well versed in genetics and other sciences. So why in places like Africa and Europe is there such a resistance to some sciences like GM in crops? Professor Pahlberg.
In the same European countries that reject genetically engineered foods and crops, there is no resistance at all to genetically engineered drugs. Recombinant drugs are now 25% of all the new drugs coming onto the market, and Europeans are perfectly comfortable with that product of genetic engineering, even though clinical trials tell them it's far from risk-free. Clinical trials actually allow us to document in great detail the risks that you take if you use a newly available recombinant drug. So my explanation for the different reaction lies not to the presence or absence of genetic engineering, but instead the presence or absence of direct benefits for ordinary citizens. Genetically modified foods and crops for consumers, they don't taste any better, they don't look any better, they don't prepare any better, they don't store any longer. They're not noticeably cheaper. The only benefits are captured by farmers who find producing these crops is more profitable because you can cut the costs of insect control and weed control, or the seed salesman, or the patent holders. Those are the only groups that benefit from this technology so far. And in prosperous countries in Europe, that's just a tiny little sliver of the population.
Yes, and one of the problems is the real success of agriculture in terms of productivity, both in America and in Europe, over the last three or four decades. It's been sensational, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The productivity growth of the agricultural sector in the United States has at times exceeded productivity growth in the industrial sector. And so the cost of producing food has plummeted, and the cost of food to consumers has been on a 100-year decline. And so consumers in both the United States and Europe don't notice and don't value any further productivity gains on the farm. And they've actually come to be resistant to those gains because they associate them with things they don't like further movement down the path toward highly specialized industrial scale factory farming that they find culturally unappealing. So the thought of new applications of science to farming in the United States and in Europe doesn't excite ordinary citizens these days. It makes them wary. And the resistance to genetic engineering in agriculture is really a part of a larger pattern of resistance to increased chemical use, increased mechanization, increased specialization. It's a part of a larger turn, a cultural turn, against highly specialized, technologically sophisticated farming.
Yes, I know the number of scientists I've talked to, such as Jim Peacock, who's the present chief scientist in Australia, who's led CSIRO plant industry and whose field is genetic engineering of crops. He, like many others, genuinely surprised when they go to announce their amazing achievements and find that people are backing away as if it's something that's yes, highly questionable. Now, your book is called Starved for Science, How Biotechnology is Being Kept Out of Africa. How is it being kept out?
Well, in the most immediate sense, by governmental regulations in the African countries. As I say, except for the Republic of South Africa, there are not any countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have yet made it legal for farmers to plant any GMO crops. Many countries in Africa do not make it legal for researchers even to do field trials with GMO crops or even to import genetically engineered foods as food aid in the middle of a food emergency.
So, yes, tell that story of the, I think it was in Zambia, that amazing paradox when they were actually starving and they brought in the crops.
Well, in Zambia in 2002, they had a drought and 1.5 million people were at risk of starvation if they didn't get food aid. And for years, the World Food Program had been providing to the Zambians food aid in the form of maize from the United States, genetically modified, since the U.S. has been planting GM maize since 1996, the same maize eaten by Americans. But in 2002, the Zambian government became anxious about this because of stories they'd heard from activists against GM crops that there might be something unsafe about this GM maize. And so the government of Zambia said, no, we don't want any GMO maize in food aid. In fact, they had to, at that point, remove some of the maize that had already been brought into the country. And the removal of that maize from one rural town led to a riot in which a guard was overpowered and the maize was stolen before it could be taken away. Now, fortunately, in this case, there was enough non-GM maize available in South Africa to replace the U.S. maize that couldn't be delivered because of this new policy in Zambia. But in the future, now that South Africa plants GM maize, it's going to be more difficult for countries such as Zambia to both get access to food aid on a timely basis and indulge a preference for 100% GM-free food aid.
Yes, didn't they grind up the maize so that there was only material that you could eat rather than the intact plant so that no genes could escape? Wasn't that done?
That was Zimbabwe's policy.
That was in Zimbabwe, sorry.
And several other African governments have said, well, we'll take it if you mill it first so that it can't possibly be planted. That's right. Of course, their concern there is that if it's planted, then importers of agricultural crops and foods in Europe will classify the country as a GM country and stop purchasing products from that country. There was even an anxiety in Tanzania that if they were to plant genetically modified tobacco, health-conscious smokers in Europe would decide that it would be inappropriate to continue importing tobacco from Tanzania.
Which is not completely
comical, because China stopped planting GM tobacco in the 1990s when health-conscious smokers in Japan decided they didn't want any.
That is choice. So a lot of this is to do with trade protocols rather than a demonstrated problem with environmental matters. So the Africans are not planting GM crops because they don't want to scare off their possible markets in Europe.
That's a part of it. Europeans have in the past said they don't want to import any beef from Namibia because it might have been fed with GM maize from South Africa. There's no trade regulation in the European Union that would prevent those imports, but private importers catering to the preferences of high-end customers in the UK told beef exporters in Namibia informally that they best not feed the animals with any GM maize.
Meanwhile, productivity in agriculture is the dead opposite of what we described in Europe and in Africa. It's not only poor, it's collapsing. How bad is it these days?
On a per capita basis, Africa is producing 20% less food than it did in 1970. Cereal crop yields in Africa are only one-third as high as they are in the developing countries of Asia. And Africa's falling farther behind because yields in Africa are increasing only one-third as fast as yields in Asia. The typical smallholder farmer in Africa earns only a dollar a day from her labor. Most are women. 80% of the agricultural labor on the farm in Africa comes from women, or let's face it, girls who ought to be in school, but instead they're out pulling weeds in the field or tending the goats. African farms are desperately poor. A dollar a day average income, and one-third of African farmers are chronically malnourished. And the projection is that it's going to worsen when the effects of climate change are factored in, a business-as-usual scenario projected out to the year 2080 sees a tripling of the number of Africans who will be suffering from chronic malnutrition, at the same time as the number of chronically malnourished people in Asia will be dropping by 90%, they will be tripling in Africa. So this is not just an unsolved crisis today, it's a crisis that's worsening rapidly.
Why is it worsening?
Because the technologies used on small farms in Africa are completely inadequate and inappropriate to the food consumption needs and to the more dense populations of Africa. In the old days, soil fertility in Africa could be restored through a system of leaving the ground idle, fallow, for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years or more. But with population growth, fallow times have been dramatically shortened to 3 years or 2 years or even 1 year. And so soil nutrients are not replaced, and crop yields in some African countries are actually dropping. Now, why don't Africans apply fertilizer? Well, fertilizer costs money, and it costs a great deal for small farmers in Africa because the transportation infrastructure is so poor. By the time you pay transport costs, fertilizer at the farm in Africa may cost 5 or 6 times as much as it does in Asia. Also, for the same reasons, Africans can't get access to hybrid seeds because the transport costs discourage seed dealers from going out into the countryside. And only 4% of cropland in Africa is irrigated. So if the rains fail, if there's a drought, Australians know something about drought. If the rains fail, these non-irrigated farmers can lose 40 or 50 or 60% of their crop, even if they do apply fertilizer, which makes investments in fertilizer sometimes irrational. So African farmers are stuck at the same very low level of technology uptake that their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were stuck at. And as a consequence, they're just as poor.
So there was no golden age when African farmers really did it traditionally and did it well, and that was all changed by modern methods?
Actually, there never really was such a golden age. Africa's wealth traditionally came from trading in gold and ivory and salt and, let's face it, slaves. More recently, from petroleum and from minerals. Smallholder farming in Africa used to be more successful than it is today, though, because you could afford to leave the land idle long enough for the nutrients in the soil to be restored naturally. There were fewer people in the countryside to feed, and the traditional management practice was able to work better than it does today. Today, as with farming everywhere, you need the uptake of some new technology, such as mineral fertilizers, such as hybrid seeds, in order to keep up with the food needs of a larger population.
Yes, but let's separate that from the GM question, because as you describe it, there are many things that African farmers could do without actually opting for the high science of GM. Why do you so much emphasize in your book, Starve for Science, the role of GM and how it could, in many ways, save African farming?
Well, I don't want to say that GM is the silver bullet solution that makes all of the other steps that need to be taken unnecessary. But there are some aspects of genetically engineered crops that are uniquely advantageous in an African environment. In Africa, where it's difficult to get access to farm chemicals, such as insecticides, it is quite advantageous for farmers to be able to plant cotton varieties, for example, called BT cotton, that can resist insect damage without insecticide sprays. Of course, that's advantageous for other reasons as well. You reduce your occupational exposure to hazardous insecticides. But if you get genetically modified cotton seeds into the hands of African farmers, then the pest protection is contained in the seed, and the seed can be replicated. So it reduces the requirement for costly and continuous purchases of inputs that are too expensive for small farmers.
We know that cotton well in Australia, don't we?
That's correct. It's being grown successfully, not just in prosperous countries, but also now in both China and India with great effect, and also in the Republic of South Africa. And it's only because of regulatory blockage that small cotton farmers in West Africa who are struggling don't yet have access to these seeds. Another new GM technology that's even more appropriate for Africa's circumstance will be crops engineered to tolerate drought. If you can't get irrigation to African farmers, the next best thing you can do is give them seeds that do better when the rains fail, seeds that will help them to stabilize their yields during cyclical droughts. This is something that at first we didn't think genetic engineering could provide, because we assumed that drought tolerance would be a multi-gene trait that would be easier to achieve through conventional plant breeding. But 4 or 5 years ago, scientists in Canada and in the United States and in the Republic of South Africa began to discover that through genetic engineering you could add considerable drought tolerance to crops. And this is being done now most aggressively in the United States by big biotechnology companies. Syngenta, Pioneer DuPont, Monsanto, they're all working furiously to develop drought-tolerant varieties of the hybrid yellow maize that's grown in the United States, in Argentina, in Brazil. They are expecting that their good commercial farmers, their good seed-buying customers, are going to be eager to reduce their risks by acquiring these drought-tolerant varieties when they come on the market in 2011 or 2012. But the farmers that really need this technology are maize farmers in Africa who, when the rains fail and their crops fail, they're pushed back into destitution. They have to sell off their household assets. They have to sell their jewelry, sell their cooking utensils, slaughter their animals, maybe even sell their agricultural implements in order to be able to raise the cash they need to purchase the food to get their family through. So a drought-tolerant variety of maize, for example, would be a technology perfectly suited to the needs of poor smallholder farmers in Africa.
But how could they then afford to buy the seed? And what's more, how do they avoid along the way being trapped in a kind of continuing process under control of the Monsantos and the DuPonts of this world?
Well, the Monsantos and the DuPonts of this world aren't paying much attention to small farmers in Africa. They're not developing drought-tolerant seeds for poor farmers in Africa because they don't have the resources to purchase seeds. There's no seed market there to interest them. So we have to count either on public sector foreign assistance agencies. Traditionally, the U.S. Agency for International Development should have done this job. Or, since USAID has mostly backed out of the business of supporting agricultural development, we have to count on philanthropic foundations. And the Rockefeller Foundation has done a wonderful work in this area over the years, but currently it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that has stepped in and tried to play this role of developing useful technologies for poor farmers who are neglected by private companies because they don't have purchasing power. So there's a new project that was just launched by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a $45 million 5-year research project designed to move drought tolerance traits into the tropical white maize varieties grown by poor farmers in Africa. And these seeds will, they won't be patented by Monsanto or DuPont. They'll be developed in the public sector by CIMMYT, the International Wheat and Maize Research Center, that has a facility in Nairobi. They'll be extended to poor farmers through NGOs. They won't be monopolized or sold just by profit-making seed companies.
And when is this going to happen? When is the tide going to turn in Africa and which countries?
Well, the drama will be by the time this research project comes to fruition in 5 years, when these new varieties suited for use by African farmers have been developed. Will governments in Africa allow their farmers to get their hands on them, or will they continue to put regulatory barriers in the path of anything that's genetically modified? That's going to be the drama.
Well, given the two people who wrote the foreword to your book, one former president of the United States, Norman Borlaug, who of course is responsible for the Green Revolution in many ways, he helped get the crops not so tall, if you like, putting all the productivity into the stem but into the top. In other words, he got the new dwarf varieties, which really transformed parts of Asia and especially India, so that instead of importing these crops, they began to be exporters, you know. So you've got some really influential people there. Have you seen people like that trying to do something in Africa that will make a difference in time, not in 5 years?
Well, I feel very fortunate to have a foreword by Norman Borlaug and Jimmy Carter, both personal heroes of mine, because of their longstanding interest and concern for small farmers, not just in Africa, but around the world. Incidentally, Jimmy Carter is ideally suited to speak with authority on issues like this, since, as he told me when I visited the Carter Center in Georgia a couple of years ago, he grows genetically modified soybeans on his own farm, and he's been able to cut down on costly herbicide sprays and reduce his tillage and conserve his soil, and he thinks it's a wonderful technology.
Yes, so next to the GM peanuts, I suppose.
That's right. We don't have those yet. But if you wanted a former president to be able to speak with authority on an agricultural technology to Africans, you cannot do any better than former President Carter. Fortunately, as well, as prominent Africans are playing a role in promoting a more rapid uptake of new technologies in Africa. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation 2 years ago launched a broad project called the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. It initially won't be using any genetically modified techniques, but the door remains open to that in the future. This is an initiative that will start with improved seeds and will then move to improved soil fertility and then improved access to water and then improved access to markets and improved policy. It's a comprehensive strategy for moving African farmers to a more productive level. And the chairman of that initiative is Kofi Annan, who is highly persuasive in explaining the political imperative facing presidents in Africa today of getting beyond their indifference to poverty in the countryside and getting beyond their anxieties about the scare stories they hear regarding the dangers of modern agricultural technology.
And the African scientists, finally?
They're ready to go. They are among the most eager to take the next step. But they've been denied resources. They work inside national agricultural research systems that have seen their budgets cut. And here we have to blame the donor community. The U.S. Agency for International Development has cut its assistance to agricultural science in Africa by 75% in the last 20 years. And when donors don't provide assistance to agricultural science, governments in Africa certainly aren't going to step in and make up that difference, because agricultural science doesn't pay off right away. It's a 5 or a 10-year lag before you get any results, and politicians normally don't work with that kind of long time horizon. So the scientific community in Africa would be eager to go forward if given the resources. And I put the blame on the donor community for pulling out the rug. Since there's been this cultural turn away from agricultural science in both Europe and North America, donors in Europe and North America have stopped providing generous assistance to agricultural science in Africa, and that's left agricultural scientists in Africa with no way to keep working. If they're well-trained, they can't work on orphan crops for poor farmers. They'll come to the United States. A good sorghum breeder from Ethiopia came to the United States and made a lot more money designing new grasses for use on golf courses.
Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Robert Paulsberg's book is called Starved for Science, published by Harvard, How Biotechnology is Being Kept Out of Africa. He's a professor of political science at Wellesley College in Boston, Massachusetts. And you might like to tune into Occam's Razor this Sunday at 8:45 in the morning when Craig Cormick offers some surprising new data on public attitudes to GM in Australia. That's ABC Radio National. Next week at this time, the story of LEDs, light-emitting diodes, and some prize-winning innovation. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.